what I've been able to read so far of Vaster Wilds and what I know of some of your previous work, I mean, some of it falls in the category of historical fiction, but I've heard you say that there had been some people in the literary world that kind of scoffed a little at historical fiction, right?
Yeah, I think in general, or at least when I was in grad school, historical fiction was looked down upon by a lot of people. Of course, you know, we've always had brilliant practitioners of historical fiction. I'm thinking of Andrea Barrett, for instance, right? I'm thinking of Jim Shepard. I'm thinking of Tolstoy, you know, George Eliot. Middlemarch is actually historical fiction. But I think at the time that I was going to grad school in the early 2000s, it was not seen as the most literary of genres. And I think it's partially because one has the conception of historical fiction as a sort of a hyper-conservative conceit, right? Because you're looking into the past as opposed to looking into the present or the future. But my contention is every book comes out of its moments, the moment of the author. And every book is actually speaking about the time that we're talking about. Even, you know, things pitched 300 centuries in the future are talking about the time that the book is actually being made. So I think our job as writers, especially writers who are literary writers, is to try to describe the current moment. And we can do that through, I guess, tools of historical fiction, of any kind of whatever tools that come to hand. These are the tools we can use to describe the current moment.
Yeah, I guess even if something's set in the future, you're writing the history of the future, I guess.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And I'm always very confused about work set in the future, even though I've done it myself, especially, you know, climate change work set in the future, because the implication is that there's going to be a survivor, right? To the person to tell the story and maybe the group of people to whom the story is being told, right? So there's all, I think, climate change fiction set in the future carries its own its own solace in some ways, right? Its own catharsis and like sweetness, even no matter how dark the future looks, there's still someone around to listen to it.
It does seem like there's a lot more successful, popular, successful works of historical fiction in recent years. What turned that tide since you were in grad school to looking more favorably on that?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Zadie Smith, too, is coming out with the work of historical fiction. Sorry, that's the lightning and thunder in Florida. Very exciting. I think a lot of people are doing it now. I don't know. You know, I think these things come in waves, as all history does and as all trends do. I think for a while, autofiction ruled the roost. And autofiction is necessarily of the moment, of the contemporary. And it's not that that's gone away, because people are still doing it ecstatically and beautifully. But I do think attention spans are relatively short, and we pick up genres that seem to have not been used and use them. And right now, I think you're right. We're in maybe a historical fiction phase at the moment.
Yeah. Not all your work falls into that category, but I mean, what do you enjoy about telling those kinds of stories?
Well, I see them as a way to make different eras, different epochs speak across the distance. Right? I sort of see them as a way of broadening the canvas that I'm using to show more of the world as it is now, right? And sort of to show the roots of how we got to where we are now. I think it's, it can be a sneaky way of writing about things that people don't think they want to read about. So, you know, I think one of the problems with writing about climate change is that it's so scary and it's so large, right? It's one of these things that is just monumental. And it's terrifying to think about long-term unless you're really steeled in doing it, right? So this is where fiction and poetry can come in and sort of talk about these issues, but maybe tell them slant, right? And I think maybe if one thinks that one is picking up a novel about 11th century nuns, like Matrix that I wrote, my last book, one does not necessarily believe that they'll be thinking about, among many other things, but climate change, right? Because that's one of the elements sort of on fire in that book in particular. So I think it's a way of talking about things a little bit more obliquely than perhaps a book set in 2023 would be, because you'd have to write about climate change, or else I think you'd be letting your reader down in a very moral sense. We can talk about many other things, right? Sort of in a sidelong way.
Yeah, and it's so much in the news, the climate change, and then, of course, to say nothing of the fear and the anxiety that it may cause. But it's so, if you just straight up wrote a story straight about climate change, plenty of people could be turned off by that, not just for political reasons, but because they just, oh man, I'm exhausted from hearing about all that. So this is another way to bring in things that you want to talk about.
Right. I mean, I don't know about you, but that's the thing that keeps me up at night, right? I mean, that's the thing that makes me want to, I don't know, go out and just like burn up oil rigs, right? I want to go like become a revolutionary. It's so anxiety provoking because it's so much larger than the individual that I know that I need to get better, but I will not probably choose to read nonfiction about climate change because I'm already so stressed out about it. You know what I mean? And yet, if someone's talking about it obliquely, I can maybe envision it a little bit better. I can actually like take it into my mind a little bit more easily.
Well, thank you even more for coming then to Houston, an oil town.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
I don't literally want to set things on fire. I just like metaphorically want to set things on fire.
All right, we'll keep an eye on her while she's in town. Okay. Note to self. So what drew you to write about Jamestown?
Oh, my goodness. So way back in 2012, I was in a doctor's office, and they had a copy of the Smithsonian magazine, which is a really wonderful magazine. I never see it anywhere else but in a doctor's office. But it had this extraordinary article about how during the starving time, the winter of 1609 and 1610, when the settlers of Jamestown were starving to death, they were subject to every disease that happened at the time, from smallpox to malaria to water-based diseases. And they had angered the Native Americans, and who were then raiding them. And there was a siege on, and it was horrific. Very, very few people ended up surviving. English people ended up surviving. And I was so fascinated because in this article, it explained that there was the remains of a young woman showed that there was cannibalism happening at the time. So you never know what article will plant a seed in you that you forget about for years and years, and then one day it sort of blooms into something really strange and unexpected. But I had carried this story around with me for a while until I reread Robinson Crusoe, which is, as you know, right, one of the greatest books of all time. It's so like strange and weird. It is really not a book that you can it's a book that you can engage with in the 21st century, but you know, you have to do a lot of explaining. If I were to teach it, I would do a lot of explaining to my students, because you know, it is the mind of a colonist, right? It's the mind of a man of his time who goes to this island and enslaves the one other person on the island, right? It's
a bit, oh, not a good look.
Not a good look. But he's also, you know, very much a Protestant Anglican of his time. All he does is he works his butt off as he's a castaway on this island. And so that and my real fascination with early American captivity narratives, particularly those of women, all these three elements came together and sort of exploded into a narrative that I really desperately wanted to tell. It was also a time when I was at peak survivalism myself in my own life, right? Where like I was stacking up on MREs, and like I have a vast library of books on how to survive, right? How to make fire out of 43 different types of things, and how to get water from the desert.
Because what led to that? What was going on there?
Oh, you know, like I do think anxiety, like generalized anxiety, understanding what's happening to the planet. So there's something about these survival narratives that acts very similar to the way that Bruno Bettelheim describes fairy tales acting, right? So fairy tales, according to Bruno Bettelheim, were these incredible inoculations against the children's anxieties as they were listening and hearing about the lives of these children whose parents sent them out into the woods to starve to death, right? About a new stepmother coming in and treating the children really terribly. So it was the worst possible things that could happen to the children. And the children are listening at the fire as these old stories are being told, and they're almost getting a vaccine against this anxiety, right? They're sort of seeing that the protagonists of the story can come through and survive based on pluck and intelligence and luck and magic, right? These are all things that come together to make these children survive. So that there's almost an alleviation of a lot of the anxiety, the existential anxiety happening at the time. And I think it's the same exact thing with these survival narratives. For me, it is really like trying to take this vast monster that is sort of crouched over my house and turning it into something that I can keep in a terrarium, right? It's not a pet, but it's something I can look at and not be afraid it's going to eat me up.
So the story, I mean, the book is centered around a young girl who's escaping out of that situation in the starvation in early Jamestown, and she's running through the woods and trying to survive on her own. And I mean, so were you at all exercising some of your own anxiety through her then in the survival story?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I also, you know, I'm deeply invested in ideas of God at the moment as well. And everything is cyclical, and things are cyclical within a human life as well. And I was raised relatively religious, deeply religious. So sort of like a hyper fervent child who believes so firmly in someone taking care of me. And that gradually over time sort of dispersed into literature, into humanism of literature. And then now in my 40s, for some reason, these ideas, the human desire to understand the ineffable, the great mysteries at the center of all things, is coming back to me really hard. And so that's the other element that's, for me, the primary element of this book. It's not necessarily the survival, but it's really encountering the deeper things, the things that are so profound that we haven't found language yet to encapsulate them.
Yeah, I was going to ask what issues that speak to us today are you kind of inserting it at a slant in this story, like climate change was in Matrix?
Well, I mean, there's a little climate change in this one as well, right? Because as soon as the colonists come over, they start changing the climate. Oh, of course, wherever there's a human being, there's someone changing the climate, right? You build a fire in the woods, and that's changing sort of the way that the woods have always been. So there's a little bit of that. There's a lot of trying to understand the role of the individual versus the role of the community. And this is something that occurs and reoccurs in all of my work. But in this particular case, one assumes that this girl is alone in the woods, but it becomes more complicated and I think more, a more subtle exploration of community is happening in this book as well. Of course, like I said, there are ideas of God and ideas of received understanding that I want to explore and actually explode in this book. So, of course, my girl who's running through the woods is an English girl, and she comes over from London, right? She's a servant. She thinks of herself as not of the elect, right? She knows because she's born into a female body, because she's born into a servant's role, she's not going to go to heaven, right? This is sort of what people believed at the time, which is horrific. So she sees herself as sort of a tool of the more powerful people around her. And she has internalized all of these narratives about who she is, who her community is, and who the people of the New World are, right? Who the native people are. And through the course of the book, through really just like understanding more and suffering and coming to through actually and like a feeling of anagogical upward momentum, she actually starts to strip all of these received ideas from her. So I wanted a book that was the opposite of a captivity narrative in some ways, that actually took the captivity narrative and gutted it. So we'll see if it succeeds for some people. That's what I intended to do for this book.
Also, you've got some books about, I mean, this one, the one before, about, you know, female characters who are doing somewhat unorthodox things in times when life was much more restrictive for women and different. I mean, what is it about that dynamic that entices you?
Well, I do think that history is written by the people who are able to write it, of course, right? And it has been in the past, especially in the West, written by white men of power and education, right? So often the experiences of those who are not deemed to be important or interesting are not, those experiences vanish because they're not written down, right? They're sort of, they're lost in the archives. They're not in the archives at all. There's this extraordinary cultural historian who's a MacArthur genius named Sadia Hartman, who does incredible work about this. And she writes these exquisitely researched, really, really beautiful books, sort of rescuing people from the shadows, rescuing people from being forgotten because they were not considered interesting or to the people who are the victors, right? They're not. So, for instance, she writes a lot about enslaved young women in the early part of this country's like development. And of course, right, if these women have been talked about, really only their names survive, right? The circumstances of their lives don't survive. But she does this thing called critical fabulation, which is she takes this research and she builds plausible lives, sort of bringing them back into life. And it's such a beautiful process, and it's a beautiful thing. And I think that that's something that fiction can do that's really astonishing, right? I think fiction is extraordinarily democratic in a very real way, because it's not necessarily about the victors, right? It can be about all of the people who are not deemed interesting enough. It can be about Napoleon, but isn't it more interesting if it's about Prince Andre on the field, looking at the sky while bullets and bombs are going off, right? I mean, isn't it more interesting to be on the battlefield rather than in the minds of the people who are vaunted as the singular genius? So I think history has seen through fiction can be thrilling and can sort of bring our perception back to times and places and people that have been skipped over.
Yeah, it seems like it really opens up so many opportunities. You think, okay, how many more stories need to be written about Napoleon? But if you start telling the stories of the peons in his life, or an unnamed girl in Jamestown, or whomever, it's, you know, it becomes, you have endlessly more material to work with.
It wouldn't be amazing? I mean, so we tend to think of history in these sort of these gloops, these mountains of great men, right? This is the way that I was taught history in American high schools and colleges. But instead of that, it really is a weave of many, many things, right? It's just daily life is, in my mind, more interesting perhaps than scaling the mountains of fame and celebrity. So just seeing some unknown blacksmith, who is attached to Napoleon's army, I think would be in some ways far more interesting and revealing of the time itself than vaunting the great man over and over again.
Yeah. Get a glimpse into what real life was like and what someone more approachable to was doing. And so, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, too, you've written, you were working on a novel about black holes at one point and then got sidetracked.
Sorry, I mean, No, well, so this book, I had finished a draft of this book when I had this amazing fellowship at Radcliffe. Harvard has this thing called the Radcliffe Institute of Advanced Study. And if you're extremely lucky, you get to spend time with other academics and artists. So I was there with Sky Hupinka, who's this incredible Native American filmmaker. I was there with great physicists, great chemists, great mathematicians, like historians, people all over the place. And every time someone got up to give a lecture about black holes, I was so excited. Like I couldn't sit in my seat. It was the most thrilling book idea. How do you write a story about black holes? How do you write, like,
yeah,
because fiction is based on humans.
Right.
So, I'm trying to figure it out. You know, we'll see. I think this is a project for 30 years from now, if I live that long, knock on wood, if we all do.
So it's not super developed then, this, but it's back. It's in the back there somewhere.
It's in the back. It's in the compost pile back there.
Well, it's cool that, yeah, I mean, obviously, if you're going to write, spend the time researching and writing to the degree that you do, you obviously want to be excited about the subject and need to be excited about the subject. So that helps, even if you're going to still trying to figure out what that's going to look like.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think there are a lot of really extraordinary books out there about absence, right? About blanks, about what happens in the center of nothing. I'm like, the short story that comes to mind right now is this incredible Lydia Davis short story called The Center of the Story, right? Which is shaped like a hurricane. And at the center of the hurricane is quiet, right? It's peace. It's calm. So I think that there's a way to find a form and a shape to write about black holes, but we'll see.
Oh, I'm so glad to get to talk to you, and thank you for making time for us.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.